What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss.
2 years ago, a fragile but hopeful peace in Sudan was broken when the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, which are both arms of the Sudanese state, went to war with each other. In the fighting since, more than 150,000 people have been killed and 13 million of a total of 51 million people have been displaced. Famine is currently significant, and there are renewed reports this week of cholera tearing through the region, which has led to corpses rotting in the Nile River, according to Al Jazeera. But during these past 2 years of civil war, most media that covers international affairs and violence, and this includes us at KPFA, has focused on international coverage elsewhere, failing to give proper attention to the conflict in Sudan, often writing it off because we don't have strong contacts or because the war is somehow over our heads. We're joined this morning to discuss the violence in Sudan, its causes, and potential pathways out by Vijay Prashad, a historian and writer and the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, which recently produced its 20th newsletter titled A Language of Blood Has Gripped Our World, Addressing the Conflict in Sudan. Vijay, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
It's always great to have you here on our airwaves. So in order to frame the ongoing fighting, let's first go back to 2019. Longtime President Omar al-Bashir was ousted by what you've described as a mass movement with support from the military. What built that mass movement, and how did it lead Sudan to experience such dramatic instability and violence just a few years after al-Bashir was toppled?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. And I think it's important to go back a little bit for this, because go back even to a country that's at the north of Sudan, which is Egypt. You remember that in 2011, there was, of course, a mass uprising in Cairo, which was then quite infectiously picked up in a couple of other Egyptian cities, Port Said, Alexandria, and so on. And this mass uprising, got the attention of the world media. It's known as the Arab Spring. It had started in Tunisia and so on. And at that time, there was a feeling that, well, the longtime ruler in Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, must go. The United States government and Hillary Clinton, as the Secretary of State, sent somebody there to try to broker a transition to see if Mubarak could stay on first and so on. Eventually, Mubarak was removed. There was great jubilation. But it became very clear, very quickly that, in fact, the civilian leader had left, but the military remained in charge. And there was a military leader who basically took over. And despite elections, eventually the military came back, and that was General Sisi. Well, it was very interesting because in 2019, when the protest movement started in Sudan and really picked up quite rapidly, very fast, it again, like in Egypt, became a mass movement. Khartoum was basically focused on this movement. It had some support in the outer regions, in Darfur and so on, just as in Egypt, there was some support outside Cairo, but it was largely a capital city movement. The teachers, the public servants and so on were very much restive on the street. And eventually, the longtime leader, as you said, Omar al-Bashir, just like Hosni Mubarak, gave up power. But again, just like in Egypt, the military remained intact and hadn't been decomposed or hadn't been, put in a way that its leaders had to remove themselves from office. And that's really incredible that in these two countries, within a decade, 2011 and 2019, almost absolutely the same grammar of politics was taking place, that longtime leader overthrown by uprising, but the military remained intact. And now this military just refused to leave and was willing, in a way, to create all kinds of projects of like platforms for what appeared to be civilian governments, bringing in even mass movements and so on. But they just wouldn't budge. There was no question of the democratization of the military. And so when, the civilian leadership tried to move on the military, there was a great question that the leaders in the military might face criminal charges, war crimes charges for the wars that had been prosecuted in Darfur and so on. These leaders of the two flanks of the military essentially went against each other. They started a civil war. They overthrew the civilian leadership. Partly, I would say, they didn't want to be sent to The Hague, or they didn't want any civilian oversight. So they preferred to tear the country apart than allow the democratization of the military. You know, in Egypt, there was a terrible massacre, the Al-Rabah massacre in a square where the military massacred a section of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was trying to prevent the overthrow of the civilian government of Mohamed Morsi. You don't have a similar massacre in Khartoum, but you have a similar overthrow of the civilian government. So yeah, these two countries basically followed each other, or Sudan followed Egypt. One, into a very, very severe military dictatorship in Egypt, which is masquerading as a civilian government, and the other in Sudan, a terrible civil war, which has inflicted pain upon every sector of society.
Well, we have to explore what could possibly make it worthwhile for these armed forces to lead to the deaths of more than 150,000 people and counting. You've suggested that the ongoing civil war, which started in 2023, has all the hallmarks of a proxy war, with the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, backed by Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, backed by the United Arab Emirates. There's potentially other outside actors pulling strings behind the scene. Can you talk to us about this idea of the proxy war and how international attention is being brought?
Yeah, I mean, so there are many levels to this. So the first thing is, it is in fact true that the two sides of the military have great antagonism against each other. I mean, it is true that General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, who leads the military, has great antipathy against Lieutenant General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who is also known as Hemeti. I mean, there is antipathy between these men. And one of the curiosities of analysis is that you want to see always, you know, many levels of why people have antipathy. There's resources, there's material gain and so on, but we generally underestimate that people can actually hate each other. And this is the first thing to put on the table, that these two sides of the military conflict are led by men who actually despise each other. The second thing is that there are, in fact, you know, many, there's a lot of resources at play. The head of the Rapid Support Forces, Hemeti, controls a great amount of gold. He's interested in preserving those parts of Sudan, particularly northern Darfur, where there are resources that he controls. You know, he doesn't want to alienate those to either the state or to Burhan and the other section of the military. The principal military force, the Rapid Support Force, was created out of the military. But so these two sections have resources that they want to protect. They don't want to alienate them or give them up to anybody. And thirdly, there are external actors at play. I mean, the United Arab Emirates in particular has had a great interest in controlling parts of this area. I mean, you know, it's a quite a shame that we haven't paid more attention to Saudi Arabia, to the United Arab Emirates, what they've been doing in this part of Africa, the Horn of Africa, and Sudan, buying up land in Ethiopia and so on, because they are worried about food security, their control over food. And there is an enormous, ravenous appetite in the bazaars of the United Arab Emirates for the gold that comes out of Sudan. Sudanese gold is a very important commodity in the UAE's markets and so on. So these regional actors, let's call them that, have been interfering in Sudan, and they've been stoking a war that could have ended a long time ago. I mean, I haven't even put the fourth element on the table, which is the arms companies. Hamdi is selling gold to the UAE in the bazaars, and that money is not going into anything productive for Sudan. It goes to buying the latest arms, and they're just firing at each other. I mean, look, I don't want to make all of this about the UAE and Egypt and all coming in and stoking the war or the arms dealers. At some level, this war does appear like the situation in George Orwell's 1984, where there are two armies that for no reason continue to fight each other. There's a little bit of that as well. There is no tangible benefit for Sudan for this conflict to continue. It should be brought to a close. It is appalling for the Sudanese people, but for at least these four reasons, there is a momentum that has not been stopped. And again, to summarize the reasons, the two generals hate each other. There is enormous material gain for them personally and for people who are with them. The regional actors are benefiting, especially Egypt, United Arab Emirates, a few others. And then finally, the arms dealers see this as an incredible opportunity to continue to sell either used weaponry or brand new weaponry, which is being used against the Sudanese people.
For listeners just tuning in, we're in conversation with Vijay Prashad, Executive Director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, discussing the civil war in Sudan. Vijay, I want to bring up one phrase that really caught me from your newsletter, which is that there are, of course, causes for this conflict, which means that there are ways for it to end. Now, you're kind of suggesting that some of the current issue is just that the two military leaders hate each other, which is a dark reality. How do you see us finding a way out of this pretty horrific conflict?
First, we've got to say that in the coverage, and I'm really glad you started by talking about the kind of real occlusion or the minimizing of this conflict. It barely gets a serious attention. I'm really glad you mentioned that. When it does get discussed, like, as you say, Al Jazeera reports it once in a way, what is really minimized even more, or actually just left out, is the fact that there is a civilian political leadership in exile, and ironically in the UAE, or in Sudan itself. Many years ago, Edward Said wrote a book called Covering Islam about how the media around the world covered the Iranian Revolution. And he made a point in this book that I've always taken very seriously, which is he said that, look, when you cover a country like Iran, take seriously the politics of the place and the fact that there are people who become politicians and represent different political currents and so on, because then you'll understand the debates and disputes within the country. And I've always taken that as a kind of a methodology for covering places where the politicians are not taken seriously. I mean, that's why during the writing of this, I spoke with Abdullah Al-Hamduk, who was the former prime minister of Sudan, to ask him, what are the different groups and what are the different conflicts and debates and so on. Well, interestingly, there has been a civilian unified bloc asking for a peace agreement, and then that bloc split pretty much along the lines of the civil war that's taking place. So now there are two military factions and two peace factions that are competing against each other. It actually shows you that the military factions have a dispute that is reflected in civil society, if you understand what I mean. It's not just that these are two men fighting, you know, the lusts of old men and so on, or their fears of being sent to The Hague, but also there is a real difference in Sudanese society, which actually could become a political difference. It need not remain a difference of the gun. In other words, if the gun is put down, they could take their political differences to the people and make it about the ballot box rather than the gun. That is not impossible. And that's what the civilian factions are saying, that, look, there could be a disagreement about how Sudan should be run, but we can take it to the people. One of the ways to do that is to take the issue of war crimes prosecution off the table. In other words, give immunity to the generals. You know, it's not worth getting them prosecuted if it means, you know, burning the whole of Sudan down, which is what's happening. So I think immunity from prosecution on the table might be one issue. The second issue might be pressure on the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and others to stop interfering in Sudan. And I'm afraid the African Union has here been very, very silent on this. The AU really needs to get its act together. The Peace and Security Council in the AU needs to act. There needs to be a much better platform of quote-unquote interference by the AU, by the African Union, rather than by these regional powers. I think that's very important. And I think globally, not just for this conflict, but globally, there needs to be much more attention on the role of the big arms companies in continuing to stoke conflict. You know, this is not just the case in Sudan, it's the case in the arming of the different factions in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. This is the case in Myanmar, where, you know, again, another conflict which has been completely unreported, a major cataclysmic conflict on the borderlands of Myanmar, which could actually overthrow three governments in the region, completely unreported. One of the principal actors there is arms companies. And I don't mean, you know, Lockheed and these companies, but the mid-level companies that sell used weaponry from one conflict to another. They play a major role in stoking conflict. And I think there needs to be much more global attention on these companies and the kind of money they make through blood.
Well, Vijay, we only have a few minutes left. I want to talk about the ongoing famine, because, of course, there is the civil war, and it's affecting actual people in Sudan in many ways beyond, of course, the horrific death count. Sudan has the largest land area for farming in all of Africa, and if there were no war, it could potentially become the breadbasket of Africa. You've suggested that wars destroy agriculture and food distribution systems, and this is the reason why there is famine in Sudan. I'm wondering if you could imagine a focus on agricultural development being at least part of a pathway out of war and to economic stability, or at least post-war creating a future economic base.
Yeah, I mean, it's really horrible. You know, there are, I don't know, over 10 million people who are displaced, at least 5 million people in a situation of near famine. I mean, in El Janina, in Darfur, in the western part of Darfur, the famine conditions are all across the region. I mean, El Janina and that region of West Darfur are interesting because, you know, one of the reasons for the Darfur conflict, which, you know, people had paid attention to earlier, and it's a whole other issue, was because the Sahara Desert is creeping downwards. The desiccation of the Sahel is a big reason for conflict. It doesn't get enough space to talk about, but you're quite right. You know, Sudan is able to have immense production of food grains. In fact, strangely, in the summer of 2024, summer of 2025, it had bumper grain production. In the middle of this conflict, parts of Sudan had a booming agricultural production. But the harvests keep getting disrupted by war, and then you get food shortages. You get now, I said, about 10 million people displaced. 20 million people are facing, a problem with food. They are food insecure. But Sudan can walk out of this as a major grain producer, not only gold, but grain. It can become one of the richest countries in that part of Africa. And you have to, in some sense, appeal to the patriotism of Hamedi and Al-Burhan to stop this war in the name of Sudanese patriotism. And I think that's what the peace groups are trying to say, that, look, this is not a basket case country. It can be a breadbasket. It can be such a great place, and if only given a chance. Sudan has effectively been at war for over 100 years, and if only it can be given a chance. What's happening in the other end of the Sahel, in Burkina Faso, with the rise of Ibrahim Traoré and so on, is really transforming African consciousness. He's put Pan-Africanism back on the table, and he's really put back on the table the idea of patriotism. Very much hope this captivates enough Sudanese people to put pressure on Al-Burhan and Hemedti to stop this war. And as I say, transform the nature of Sudan so it becomes not a word synonymous with genocide and war, but in fact with the production of food and with the happiness of its people.
Well, we are going to have to end it there, but we are also going to be hoping for a world where Sudan can exist in peace. Vijay Prashad, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And that's the voice of Vijay Prashad, a historian and writer and the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, which recently produced its 20th newsletter titled A Language of Blood Has Gripped Our World, addressing the conflict in Sudan. You can check out more of their work at thetricontinental.org. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law & Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.